This is Conversations on KUAC-FM Fairbanks. Our program today is called, Is There a Doctor in the House? In the next hour, we'll take a look at conventional and unconventional medicine from the perspective of one who has practiced both. I'm Susan McGinnis, your host for Conversations. Dr. Sandra Denton completed her internship in internal medicine at St. Luke's Episcopal Hospital in Houston, Texas. And thereafter, she specialized in emergency medicine with a particular expertise in poisons and toxicology for 14 years. Just 5 years ago, Dr. Denton became convinced of the benefits of nutritional and preventative medicine. She is now in private practice with Omni Medical Center in Anchorage, a clinic known for its holistic approach to the treatment of what ails us. You know, this probably isn't 100% true, but it seems to me in some ways that conventional medicine and holistic medicine look at each other across a wide gulf, at least perceptually in this country. On the one side, conventional practitioners tend to call, some call, holistic practitioners quacks and purveyors of snake oil. And on the other side, the most rigid, we might say, of holistic practitioners will look across the gulf at conventional physicians and say that you people slice and dice and mutilate people, and you're stuck on pharmacology, and you're rigid in your own perspectives, and you won't think about broader elements of health. I look at you as someone who's practiced both, and I wonder, first of all, if there isn't a middle view, can these two disciplines ever get along?
That would be the ideal situation, and I would like to think that one day we may see that. I certainly can appreciate the benefits of both, and I will tell you shortly how I came to cross the gap, so to speak, but in other countries, they have been able to bridge the gap, and I know that it's quite common, say, in the Chinese hospital, for a patient to have undergone surgery by a traditional orthodox surgeon, and yet an acupuncturist come in and treat certain points that prevent that person from developing the postoperative pneumonia, or using different points to prevent the bladder retention that so commonly occurs after surgery, and therefore doing away with the necessity for that patient to be catheterized and setting up a chance of infection. And so they have done quite well at blending the two specialties together. And there are a few physicians around the country that are beginning to be a little bit more open-minded on both sides and to know when one can bridge the gap. I have to speak in defense of my colleagues, however, because for many years, those 13 and a half years that I practiced traditional medicine, I myself would tell patients when they would say, well, should I take vitamins? And I'd say, oh, no, 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 don't waste your money. Just eat a balanced diet, you know, blah, 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 because that's what I had been taught in medical school. And that was what the teaching that was maintained all those years. And when enough people began asking me over and over those questions, somehow inside of me, I thought to myself, what if they're right? What if there's something here that I just haven't seen before? And so I began doing a little bit more reading. And another thing, in the emergency room, as most people know, we get the car wrecks and the shootings and the heart attacks and the acute injuries. But we also saw a lot of people that would come in, and it was very frustrating because the nurse would hand me a chart and she would say, oh, get the patient out of room 2. This is the third time Mary Jane's been in this week, and there's nothing wrong with her. She's just a crock. And I would pick up the chart, and I would go into the room, and I would look at this pathetic person, and I could just feel that there had to be something wrong with that person, that they weren't making this up, and that somehow we just simply didn't have an answer to that person's situation. And instead of getting rid of the person, I always spent more time with him, and I kept scratching my head, and most of the time I couldn't find an answer. However, when I began doing some reading and attending some meetings, some of the pieces of the puzzle started to fit together, and I became much more aware of different causes of symptom complexes. For example, if this Mary Jane had been in for the third time that week with headaches or something, and once we've ruled out brain tumor and this, that, and the other, and if there's nothing else that's apparent, well, she's a crock and she's just after dope. That wasn't necessarily the case, and as I began studying the things that I've learned over the past 5.5 to 6 years, and by the way, it's almost as if I have gone back to medical school, and every condition that I learned in school, I have now a whole new treatment plan, a whole new diagnostic protocol. It's like you almost erase the blackboard and start it all over. And I, of course, haven't erased the blackboard. I still remember the things that I was taught, but I have a whole nother viewpoint of that perspective now. And it's quite rewarding to be able to come up with answers for these people. And maybe it's because all those years in the emergency room that I saw so many of these people coming in with their chronic problems and nobody having answers for them. And they stuck in my heart. And, you know, we really... doctors, for the most part, really do care about their patients. And as I began learning some of the things that we'll talk about today on the program, I've discovered some of the answers to the problems, and we're able to keep those particular people maybe out of the emergency room and perhaps not requiring the dope as they were being given simply to cover up the symptoms.
Can you give us a working definition of holistic medicine? And is that the word under which you operate, the phrase?
It's a difficult what to call this.
Right.
You know, some people call this alternative medicine. On the other hand, when I went to speak at a conference in Athens, Greece, a couple of years ago, I had to smile because our alternative medicine was their traditional medicine. 60% of the physicians in that audience were acupuncturists, you know, and that's somewhat new to us in the Western medicine. So that term didn't really apply in that setting. And some doctors have come up with a term of complementary medicine in hopes of just what you were mentioning in the beginning of the program, of a bridge of how we can complement what orthodox medicine is doing, perhaps how we can assist the immune system, how we can help a person by changing their lifestyle, complement what they're doing otherwise. Holistic, and sometimes it has unfortunately received a bad connotation, but the idea is looking at the whole person, that you can't just treat a physical body and totally ignore that person's mental state at that time, or what's going on in their home situation or their work environment, or even the fact that their spiritual health may play a role in their physical body. And so a truly holistic physician doesn't just focus on the sore throat that you come in with, or the headache that you have, or the stomach ache that you have, but also inquires into these other two realms as to what's going on and what may be playing a role there. For example, I had a man come in with pain in his stomach, and he was concerned that it might be an ulcer. In fact, some doctor had just simply written out a prescription for one of the commonly prescribed ulcer medications today. And he thought that there might be a different approach to that. And after I spent a few minutes with getting down the basics, you know, when does the pain happen, how long does it last, what helps it, this, that, and the other, the typical questions that we're all trained to ask, then I ask, what was happening in your life before these symptoms came on? And it had turned out that he had gone home and he had witnessed over that month his father's death. He had taken care of his dad for 24 hours a day for that last period of time and assisted his mother, and there was just a lot of intense pressure there. And after his dad was buried, he flew back and went to work the next day. And there was no time for him to sort through his own grief or his own feelings as to what all had happened in that episode. And when we pointed that out to him and we assisted him in making and taking some steps here, his pain totally disappeared. So it didn't take a medicine. It took sorting out what was the probable cause and helping him to deal with that and to make a change in that area, and not giving him an antidepressant, so to speak, but just helping him to focus on how he could work through that. It's very rewarding. We want to see our patients getting well, and it's extremely rewarding to help them find out what is perhaps the cause, that they're not crazy, that there is something behind all of this, and to assist them with making changes that enhance their health and enhance, in many cases, their work, their ability at the office to focus and concentrate, or if it's a child, the ability to concentrate in this classroom. Interpersonal relationships are often affected by the way one is feeling, and just to help that person have more self-respect.
Let me say, for those who've tuned in after the hour, that you're listening to the voice of Dr. Sandra Denton. She is in private practice at Omni Medical Center in Anchorage, was for 14 years an orthodox physician, working especially with poisons and toxicology, and in the past 5 and 6 years has turned her interests more to nutritional and preventive medicine. A conventional physician might turn to you and say, that's an anecdotal evidence of improvement in someone. And yes, of course, if someone's grieving, you might want to deal with the grief to find the answer to the stomach problems. But that conventional medicine is rooted in double-blind experiments and the scientific method, which proofs cannot be found for what we call alternative medicines in this country.
On the other hand, there are many articles in the literature, if they will simply look, that do validate the use of herbs, for example, in certain conditions. More and more textbooks are coming out with the scientific evidence. And to even do the research that's necessary to prove a point, one, in the first place, has to make an observation. And we're supposedly smart, and when we see over and over and over again that following certain pathways, the patients get well time and time again, then that certainly should set up the protocol necessary to do the research to prove these points. But in many of the situations, for example, for a few years there was a drug on the market known as Bendectin, and that was used in women who were pregnant and were having a terrible time of nausea. And some of these women couldn't even go to work or function. They were so sick. And so the doctor would write out the prescription, Bendectin. And eventually that was taken off the market for fear that there was something in it that was harmful. And the OBGYN specialists were going, oh, no, what are we going to do now? And one of my former colleagues, Dr. Jonathan Wright, who has done a lot of work in nutrition, wrote the organization and said, in your own journal in 1930-something or other was a wonderful article showing how B12 and B6 was perfect at fighting off nausea of pregnancy. And in fact, one of the active ingredients in the drug Bendectin was B6. But he never heard a response from them, and they tend to have just overlooked or bypassed some of these articles that do exist. And a lot of different questions and wondering why that could be, but perhaps the pharmaceutical interest these days. B6 is, you know, you can't patent B6. It's over-the-counter available. Whereas Bendectin or any of the other drugs that might come on the market, there is a patent available for that.
So there may be other interests, pharmacological interests. There may be a blind spot. We don't look for certain causes because it's not what we've paid attention to. It's not
right.
What we've studied.
And the average physician of today is not familiar with some of those articles, mm-hmm. Nor does he have the time to take to go and research it and look them up. I remember when I was going through school that my first doctor coat, you know, the white coat that we're so proud of because that gives you a certain status, you've completed the first 6 months of medical school. Oh, I was so proud until one day I walked down the hall and I saw the janitor had a white coat on too. But anyway, up until that time, it was just I could hardly wait to get my white coat. And that was supplied to me by one of the pharmaceutical industries. My first stethoscope came by another pharmaceutical industry. My first doctor's bag came from a pharmaceutical industry. I never heard of a vitamin representative in my whole medical career, or in the years after I was in practice in the emergency room. I never was visited by anybody that told me about vitamins and minerals and that type of thing. It was foreign to me. And I really had to get down and dig it out and to learn more about this type of medicine.
From your perspective, are there serious consequences to focusing on drugs as a solution to illness?
Well, there could be. I think one thing that seems to be forgotten, and please don't misunderstand, I'm not saying that herbs are the only answer, but many of the drugs have come from herbs, and they try to identify the active ingredient in an herb. For example, Lanoxin or Digoxin, the heart medication, comes from the herb foxglove. And while identifying out the active ingredient, we are forgetting that the other items in that herb are acting as cofactors in assisting that active ingredient do a better job. And more importantly, Susan, there are other ingredients in that herb that counter the side effects of that active ingredient, which is so important. There's not a medication around today, including aspirin, that does not have side effects. And so it's a matter of when a physician writes out a prescription, he theoretically should be aware of all of those side effects and weigh the risk-benefit. But the actuality is that most of us can hardly keep up with all the side effects of the medicines. The PDR, the physician desk reference, which list all the drugs and their side effects, it's unbelievable to try to find a particular drug in there and read the two or three pages of side effects and forgetting sometimes how this drug interacts with the 13 others that the patient's already on and has been given those by other doctors that you may not even be aware of. That's where we tend to get into a little bit of problems. And again, going back to identifying possible causes. Example, a patient comes to me with high blood pressure. Young woman in her 30s, and she's on four different medications. It's hard enough for her to remember when to take these, but these do have side effects. They do mount up in expense-wise. And I'm taking a history from her, and just going through her daily routine, find out that she drinks 6 to 8 cups of coffee a day. Well, Susan, by simply taking her off of the coffee, she was able to discontinue every one of her blood pressure medicines. I find that phenomenal, that she didn't have a deficiency of these medications. She had caffeine abuse. And to help her in looking at her lifestyle and making a change there, by the way, she could sleep better at nights. She wasn't as anxious or uptight, so she could also stop her Valium. But no doctor in all of these 15 years that she had suffered with high blood pressure had ever inquired about her diet. And it's just little things like this, and it's fun. It's fun being a doctor now and getting in there and just working with the patient. That may be a difference as well. Oftentimes, the patient comes to the doctor and tells their symptoms, and the doctor says, okay, you take this and be gone with you. And in our setting, it's a teamwork. It's assisting that person to become more tuned in to what their body is telling them and to pay attention to it, not ignore it, not say, well, I'm reaching 30 or, you know, I've had a lot of stress lately or this or that and the other, and just suppressing those symptoms, but to begin to identify when they may be not feeling very well and what happened right before that, and could there be something that they could change.
I read somewhere recently that people who keep journals tend to be overall healthier than people who don't, and it stopped me, and I thought, no, for heaven's sakes, this doesn't make sense. But the writer went on to say the reason is because people who keep journals take note of how they're feeling physically, emotionally, spiritually, what they've been doing, what events or activities that have had impact on their lives. And so what they have is kind of a running thermometer of what's going
on. Exactly.
So they're more aware. And in any case, even if they didn't feel well, the assumption is if they brought their situation to you or to a conventional doctor, they'd bring more information.
Exactly.
Yeah, all right. So it's a good argument for the, no matter who you go to, for the person to know more about themselves.
Right. Yeah. And then you have to be a little bit careful when you take that information to the doctor, because he sees this pile of stuff coming in and he says, oh my God, we've got a hypochondriac here. Uh-huh. So you need to find a doctor that's willing to listen and to accept that you have a mind and a brain and that you're pretty smart and that you can put some things together and to work with you on piecing together what that might mean.
You've mentioned food and vitamin B6 and vitamin B12. You've mentioned caffeine. And how important, that's what I want to ask you, how important is food in a person's health?
It's extremely important, and I was not made aware of that during my medical training. I had very little nutrition in my medical school training. In fact, I got more nutrition in my high school PE class than I did in medical school.
We worry more about the organs and the bones than we do
yes,
about what goes into them?
Yes, and the diet of students these days is loaded with soda pop and fast foods and things like this, and yet we're not aware of what that's doing to our mind and our ability to learn and to concentrate. The most common symptom that I hear in my practice, and I don't care if we're talking about a child all the way up to a 70-year-old, the most common symptom is fatigue.
Yeah, I could have guessed.
I am so tired I can't get dressed in the mornings, or I have to go home from work and I collapse, or just on and on and on. And it is surprising how many young people are giving this symptom. You might not think, well, if it's a 50 or a 60-year-old or a 70-year-old, that's just their age. But it's not. It's occurring in very young people. And then we start to investigate, what are they eating? What are they feeding their body? What fuel are they giving this incredible machine that we've been given? They take better care of their car than they do their body. They're not getting enough sleep. They're putting all kinds of fast food in, processed foods, the Cokes, the coffees. They're not giving any attention to it. And I have to laugh at this point, Susan. I've warned my patients for years that eating in fast food restaurants might be harmful to their health. And this past week in a newspaper article, there was a heading that said, Sheriff's deputy storm McDonald's, grab gum and free last of 20 hostages. So what can I say? But anyway.
But nutritionally, it's not good. I mean, even if you're not faced with a gunman and 20 hostages.
Right. It's not good. We are consuming foods that have many chemicals, have been processed. There's hardly any nutrition left in the food. Ideally, we should be getting raw fruits and vegetables, or lightly steamed nuts and seeds and the whole grains, not the processed foods. They did a study a few years ago, and they had a group of animals, and they gave them the contents of a very common breakfast cereal these days, and they gave another group of animals, they ground up the boxes that these cereals came in. Guess which group did better, Susan?
The
one with the boxes. Yes, that's been done by a major university study. So what are we putting into our body, and how, you know, how can this body perform if we don't give it the right raw material? And it is incredible that, yes, what we eat does matter to how we feel and how we function.
You're listening to Dr. Sandra Denton, who works with Omni Medical Center in Anchorage. It's an alternative health center, holistic health center. And this is Conversations. I'm your host, Susan McInnes. We should eat right. How do we untangle the direction to eat right? It is very confusing. If you walk into a grocery store, there are some unconfusing aisles. The fruit and vegetable section is basically unconfusing. The meat and fish section is basically unconfusing. Everything else in the store is patently confusing. There are 100 different kinds of cans and boxes and packages. Most of them say that they're the healthier, or they're better, new and improved, from the soap line all the way into to the breakfast cereal line. I pass people who are sitting reading or standing reading the backs of packages.
Good for them.
Still in all, it's a confusing thing to do.
We've been advised that, for the most part, when you go into a grocery store, if you just shop the perimeter, which is where the produce and the meats and things of this nature usually are, and skip the inner rows where have the packages and the boxes and the canned goods, that you'll probably do better. One point of advice is that, yes, I do shop at health food stores. primarily, mm-hmm. but not everything in a health food store is necessarily healthy. You still have to read labels. And to go and eat a whole package of fruit-sweetened cookies is still perhaps not in your best interest, even though it came from a health food store.
Is the best advice to think about what you're doing?
Think about what you're
doing. Treat food seriously.
What is this food going to do for you? I think that's more important than perhaps even what is it going to do to you. But is it going to do something for you? Is it going to give you the energy that you're looking for? Or when you eat it, are you going to go to sleep a few minutes later? That's very important. When I'm looking at a soda pop in a can, I'm thinking about the metallic content, that's the aluminum, the tin that's going to come out of that metal. And here we are, a country with increasing Alzheimer's disease, which has been linked to increasing amounts of aluminum and other metals in the brain. There is nothing in that soda pop can, nothing that is going to be beneficial for me. So why spend my money on it and drink it? I need to look maybe toward the fruit juices or to possibly just drinking good, pure water. Mm-hmm. You know, hardly anybody drinks water anymore. And then we wonder why we have increasing, you know, problems with kidney disease and dry skin and all the complications arising from that. If we just drink more water in between meals, we would be far better off.
What about milk?
I often advise my patients, contrary to what the Dairy Association says, it's the perfect food, that milk turns out to be the most commonly allergic food. In other words, there are foods in our diet, and just about everybody has one or two of these foods that we are eating on almost a daily basis that are causing problems in our body, and milk is at the head of the list. There are five very, very common allergic foods: milk, wheat, soy, egg, and corn. And as you can tell, these are things that would appear almost in every meal. And they can be the cause, they can be good foods, but they can be the cause of a person's health problems.
Because of that person's makeup?
Because of that person's makeup, because of over the years they have developed allergies to these particular foods. The fact that milk, as adults don't really have the enzymes necessary to properly break down and digest that milk, that's a whole different problem in addition to the allergy problem itself. Just as an example, Alex Schoss has done a lot of research on diet and behavior. In fact, he wrote a book called Diet, Crime, and Delinquency. And in that book, he gives the study of a series of juvenile offenders. And they found that this group of juvenile offenders had twice the milk consumption as the average young person in that day. And this ties in nicely with the fact that food allergies can change behavior and change the way a person can concentrate and focus. I see it a lot in my hyperactive children in classes, and we have an epidemic of hyperactivity and children who are placed on the drug Ritalin. In fact, if we find out, though, in testing them that they are allergic to certain foods, for example, oftentimes milk and dairy products are high on the list, take that food out of the diet, reduce the amount of sugar in that diet, and supply a couple of nutrients that that child might be deficient in, their behavior totally changes, and they don't need the drug Ritalin, which does have side effects over a long period of time.
Do you think that's the first course of defense, is taking a look at someone's diet?
Absolutely. Every patient that I see, that's one of the very first things that I investigate, is what is the diet like? It is extremely important.
Do you find that we know what we eat?
Good question. A lot of people have to really sit there and think what they had to eat the last meal. They're so accustomed to driving through somewhere and just grabbing something and going on. But many people are becoming aware more and more that this is a problem. In fact, that's why many of the fast food stores have put salads in their stores. There's enough public pressure of people becoming aware, and the consumer can make change. Mm-hmm. We've seen that happen, and I'm proud of them for doing that. The manufacturers are becoming smart, and they see as you mentioned earlier, that people are reading labels. They know that many people have become aware that sugar is perhaps not very good for us. And they know that in the label, things are listed according to quantity in that product. And so in order to get around this, they have perhaps split up the sugar into its components, such as dextrose and corn syrup and high fructose and this, that, and the other. And those items might be listed down in the order of ingredients.
But if because you took they're separated
them, out. They're separated out. But if you put them all together, it would perhaps be the first ingredient. So it's still a game, and the consumer still needs to be educated and alert to that fact.
What about sugar substitutes? I have among my friends people who no longer put sugar in their coffee and other
right.
things, but they use a lot of whatever those things are, NutraSweet and things like that.
Right.
Are those bomb or okay?
I would almost rather a person be off the NutraSweet than the sugar. It seems to be an even more hazardous substance. It's a chemical. There have been connections between this particular product and, or aspartame, I won't just perhaps be against that brand, but the substance itself, with increased incidence of headaches, increased incidence in some people of seizure activity. It was never meant to be used as in the quantity that we're using it today. When the original studies were done that quote-unquote question mark proved its safety, no one had any idea that it would appear in cereal, bread, chewing mm-hmm. gum, soda pop, puddings, Jell-O, everything. You can find practically anything with that type of sweetening in it. And in that quantity, it is raising some serious concerns, and there is a book out now on it that is scientifically based. I do advise my patients to stay off of it. Case in point, had a young man discharged from the service as a paranoid schizophrenic. And we, investigating his nutrition, found that he was drinking 6 to 8 diet sodas a day, taking him off of the diet soda. And there could have been a combination of the sweetener plus the soda itself. But 3 psychiatrists examined him after that point, and he was totally symptom-free, declared normal. That's what can happen. The things that we're putting in our body can affect the chemistry of the brain as well as our muscular ability and our energy levels.
Literally, you are what you eat.
And absorb. Yes.
What you mentioned vitamins. If I am eating, if one is eating a good diet, does one in this day and age need extra vitamins? And if you're not eating a good diet, will vitamins repair your abuse or lack of nutritional intake?
Good question, both of them. If you're eating a lousy diet, at least taking some vitamins may help delay the ill health that you are bringing about on your body. I don't think it can totally compensate, but it may make the process a little bit less severe. And even if you are eating a quote-unquote, question mark again, healthy diet, the soil has been so depleted of the minerals that unfortunately many of the things that we are eating right out of the garden still do not have the nutrients that they once did. And in the environment in which we live, with all the chemicals that we have no choice or no say-so about the exposure, you know, a diesel truck drives by, you can't just hold your breath the whole time they're driving by, and what appears in the water supplies and in our heating systems and things of this nature. So we are under quite a bit of attack from the outside world, the environment in which we live. And for that reason, we probably need to be taking additional vitamins and supplements to counter that as well, particularly the B vitamins, which help us somewhat with handling stress. Vitamin C, which is an excellent immune system builder and detoxifier. And I know there's a lot of controversy about vitamin C, but I happen to see it work quite well for a lot of my patients, and I take it myself. I've read a lot of the works by the twice Nobel Prize winner Linus Pauling, and there's definitely some validity there.
two quick follow-up food questions, and then I want to change our path here for a little while. If there are people listening who will be saying to themselves, all right, I should be eating right, and yes, vitamins may be helpful, but I'm still not sure how to create for myself a good diet and a good dietary supplement. Do you know of, say, a couple of good books to recommend regarding diet and regarding vitamins that would be helpful for the layperson who wants to become healthier?
Lyndon Smith has written a couple of books. One is Feeding Your Kids Right, and another book is called Feeding Yourself Right. And both of those are easy to read and are very useful and helpful. There are several out there on the market. It's really hard to pick one or two that come to mind that are at the top of the list. But going into the local health food store and perhaps talking to the owner of the store, not just the salesperson perhaps, but someone that appears to be knowledgeable, and they can often direct you to some reading material that's helpful. And in the area, there may be some nutrition-oriented physicians or that could give assistance on that. Basically, there is no one diet that works for everybody. We need to be aware that we are individuals. And this was what was so confusing to me when I first began to learn this type of medicine. As I will repeat, I had absolutely almost zero nutritional training in medical school. So when I began to learn all this, it was a zoo for me. It was very confusing. One doctor was saying, you know, eat meats, and one doctor was saying, oh, you should be a total vegetarian. Another was saying this and this and that. And it was like for 1 or 2 weeks I would go back and I would tell all my patients that they should be eating this. And then I would go hear another speaker and listen to this group, and I would, and it was like, oh dear, I don't want to steer the people wrong. What is right? What is actually right for the people? Well, as I said, no one diet fits everybody. You have to evaluate each individual, what their needs are, what's the amount of stress that they're under, what climate do they live in, because people here in Alaska require a totally different diet than people that live in Hawaii. You may require, Susan, a certain diet during the winter months, but a different diet during the summer months. Or if your level of stress is raised, then there's certain things that you might need to alter in that diet to help you get through the stress better, and that you can become more lax on when things are back to, quote, normal, if that's possible. And it's really ideal to have somebody that's a little bit trained in that area, and you begin to detect yourself when you're eating what you feel good on.
What about exercise?
Again, absolutely important for stimulating the immune system and building up your resistance and handling stress. The more hectic my life becomes, the more I need to put exercise in there so that I don't lose it.
And immediately someone is going to say to you, Doctor, I don't have time to exercise. I have kids, I have a job, I have a house to run, I've got volunteer committees I serve on.
Just about everybody has 15 minutes. And if they can pull out like a mini trampoline or a bicycle or something, do something for 15, jump rope for 5 minutes, you can come up with that length of time. You don't have to go off for an hour to an hour and a half formal exercise class. There are lots of different ways of doing it in a short period of time. I also tell my patients that the exercise should be tailored, again, to the individual. You know, it needs to be something that you somewhat enjoy, have fun, can laugh, can smile, maybe playing a peppy tape in the background of stimulating music or a humorous tape or something of that nature to make it pleasant as well. But it's extremely important, and especially in this day and time of all of our stress that we're under, we need something to let as an outlet for that stress, and we feel more energetic. I tell most people it's probably better if you can do it first thing in the morning, but if you can't do it any other time, then at the end of the day is satisfactory.
You mentioned laughing, enjoying yourself. Norman Cousins has written extensively his first book, Anatomy of an Illness, and I see you've got a second book coming out called Head First, The Biology of Hope, by the same gentleman. He clearly maintains that his changing, evolving, transcending mental state was one of the primary curative factors in bringing him from deathly ill twice in his life.
Yes.
To a good, healthy body again. What's your perspective? You're in agreement.
I'm in absolute agreement. I think humor and laughter and a positive mental attitude means so much to all of us, but particularly to the person who is struggling with what may be a catastrophic disease. And in our clinic, for example, when our patients might be getting or receiving intravenous therapy, I have certain videos that I play for them, and many of them are quite humorous, maybe the football bloopers or something of that nature. Our society today is not very happy. You turn on the news and there's the reports of the economy falling in the Middle East and this going, and you're just like, oh my God. And you go to work and somebody says, Susan, did you read the newspaper today, or did you hear about this, or do you know what happened to Joe Blow? And it's like, oh. And I'm very careful what I pick out at times to go to the movies, you know, and I advise my patients, be more selective at what you're putting in your brain. Sometimes when I come out of the movie, I am exhausted. I mean, I've been driving this car through all this thing, you know, and dodging bullets and whatever, and I'm just like, whew. And however, if I can choose a movie or a video that has some humor or inspiration in it, and I can come out of there with just like a, aha, the world is a good place to live, and I can participate in that, and I can make it better, I'm going to handle stress around me a lot better. I'm going to be a better person to other people around me too. So absolutely, humor. And we have to put that in. It's a choice, just like what we put in our body to eat. It appears that we have to schedule in sometimes putting in good inspirational things into our mind.
I can hear somebody out there saying, boy, that's artificial. Give me a break. I can't decide that at 3 in the afternoon on Thursdays I'm going to enjoy myself. It's not spontaneous. It's not real. I don't feel like enjoying myself.
I understand that. It's kind of funny, but you get creative at producing things like this. And in fact, one of the laughter videos that we have in the office is, there's several segments on there of these people just laughing hysterically. And mornings is not one of my best times. You know, when that alarm clock goes off and it's just like, I'd like to tell you that I bound out of bed and I just go, hello world, I'm ready for you. But the truth is, Susan, that more likely I would just like to pull the covers up and turn over and go back to sleep. And so knowing this about myself, I made a cassette tape of just some of those segments of that video of these areas of laughter. And I put that on my alarm clock tape.
You don't.
And a few mornings, that's what I wake up to. Now, you can't lay there for very long with this laughter, this hysterical laughter going out without a smile creeping into your face. And pretty soon you're laughing too. And that's a much better way to start your day and get up and do some things. And I often put other things on, you know, inspirational songs like mm-hmm. Chariots of Fire or something as I'm waking up. And we can do little things like that during our day to make it brighter and to brighten up somebody else's day. But you do have to be a little bit creative about it.
Does it do more than banish the cynic? I hear periodically that there is beginning to be evidence that one's mental state is reflected in one's physical state.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Is it more than anecdotal? Is it more than hopeful?
Norman Cousins, and this is what's presented in his book Head First, for the last 10 years has been on the faculty of the UCLA in California, and they have proven scientifically that indeed this type of attitude does have a positive effect on the immune system and on the white blood cell and on the body's ability to fight off disease and to sometimes turn around catastrophic situations for which we physicians say you have no hope, turn hopeless cases into success stories. You bet.
Hmm. You're listening to Dr. Sandra Denton. She works in private practice with Omni Medical Center in Anchorage. Dr. Denton took her internship in internal medicine at St. Luke's Episcopal Hospital in Houston, Texas, emerging from that facility in 1971. She worked for almost 14 years in emergency medicine, trauma medicine, and her specialty was poisons and toxicology, to which subjects I want to turn this discussion now. You have been one of a growing number of people who have been questioning whether dentistry should include the placement of amalgam fillings, what we commonly call silver fillings in teeth. part of your questioning, if you'll just let me package this a little bit, is that your belief with others is that vapors from these fillings are actually released and that these vapors cause physical problems. You're not alone. In the last couple of months, the Chicago Tribune has addressed in a front page splash headline the subject, USA Today more recently. Most recently, the October 15th, 1990 edition of Newsweek addressed it. With that kind of background and awareness that we don't have a lot of time to look at it, I want to ask you to address briefly what you feel the problems are in silver amalgam fillings and what problems you think they're causing to bodies. These have been used since the late 1890s, right? Over,
yes.
What, billions have been put in teeth around the world.
That's right. And it is a fact that mercury does come out of the filling. And for many years, this was not known by much by the dentists that were using it. However, it's kind of interesting that the very first dental society that existed in this country was aware of the poisonous nature of mercury. And they made their members sign pledges that they would not use this vile substance. But a growing number did, and because of economic reasons and because of the ease in which you can place these fillings, more and more dentists began using that and somewhat ignoring the original warnings that appeared about the substance. And the ADA was formed out of that, and the original Dental Society dissipated. And so for many years, the thought was that once this mercury was bound with the other metals in that filling, that it was no longer a problem. It was no longer a poisonous substance.
It locked in.
That's what they believed. However, over the past 10 years or 15 years, researchers around the world have been measuring mercury vapor coming off of the filling. They are tracing it in accumulating in other organs of the body, primarily in the brain, in the adrenals, the kidneys, interfering with enzyme systems in the body, and causing a host of problems anywhere from, in some cases, migraine headaches, other cases intense fatigue, other cases recurring infections, some people say joint problems, et cetera, to even more severe health problems such as neurological disorders that mimic multiple sclerosis, for example, and more recently Alzheimer's disease has been tied in with that possibility that it could be linked with mercury. Researchers from the University of Kentucky have measured excess amounts of mercury in the brain of Alzheimer victims versus control patients. And a former Alzheimer victim, Tom Warren, wrote the book Beating Alzheimer's Disease, and he himself had been diagnosed by several physicians in 1982 and 83 as having Alzheimer's disease. He had, in fact, an abnormal CAT scan in 83, and with reading and taking his responsibility for his health, was able to totally reverse that diagnosis, and in 1987 has a perfectly normal CAT scan, and was able to write his book. He's back in working now in an office, and to talk to him on the phone, you would have no evidence that he ever had Alzheimer's disease. The only problem with this, Susan, is that in order to diagnose Alzheimer's disease today, you have to have an autopsy, and Tom Warren did not oblige us. But and there appears to be several others that are following his footsteps who have been given that diagnosis, but who, through hearing about Tom and through other people, are looking at things in their environment, among which include the mercury fillings, and upon removal of those toxic substances, are regaining their health. There is one lady in the Illinois area that had multiple sclerosis, very well documented by many physicians, and she reversed her condition totally by having her mercury fillings removed, and she has since formed the National Patient Support Group of mercury victims.
This is an incredible charge to a stable medical practice over 100 years old. It must meet tremendous and immovable resistance from the dental community.
It has. Again, most of the dentists are very conscientious. and they simply have not seen the scientific papers. I must have between 2,500 and 3,000 papers now from around the world documenting the toxicity of mercury, the problems coming out of the fillings and affecting people's health. There are a growing number of dentists, however, who have begun to read about this, who have seen changes in their own patients, who have come back to them after they've had the fillings removed and said, "Remember me? You know, I was the one that had this, this, and this, and it's gone now." Recently, this past September, there was a lawsuit filed against the American Dental Association for fraudulent misrepresentation. This was filed by over 35 dentists who are members of the organization and who are very angry that over the course of years, their association has continually and purposely conveyed misinformation with regard to not only the mercury fillings, but other factors such as water fluoridation and fluoride itself. And they are filing this lawsuit as a breach of contract and, as I said, misrepresentation to them. The dentists rely upon that association to give them information. And I must say that the organization has had most of the information that I have had access to, but apparently for whatever reasons choose to ignore it. In Sweden, this was also the case, but a patient organization of over 7,000 members finally brought change in that country and have forced the dental association to acknowledge that, yes, this is a problem, and that between 1991 and 1992, the mercury fillings will be banned and other materials used in their place. They have already banned it in the use among pregnant women and small children because of its known effects on causing birth defects and problems in that area.
Sweden, Germany, and Japan, are those the three countries?
Right.
That have done something in this area.
Right.
In this lawsuit, will the doctors have to prove the toxicity and the toxic effects of mercury in order to prevail?
I don't know, but the proof is coming forth very nicely for us from Dr. Vimy at the University of Calgary in Canada, who and his associates who have shown mercury coming out of the fillings that were placed in sheep and crossing, these were some pregnant sheep as well as others, crossing the placental membrane and going into the fetuses and accumulating in the organs of the fetuses in higher concentration than in the mother. They were also placed, the amalgams, in other sheep and found a decrease of kidney function between 18 and 60% within a two-month period. Other researchers out of University of Georgia have proven that mercury coming out of amalgam fillings can distort the bacteria, the normal bacteria, in the intestinal tract, and thereby setting up the conditions for disease to occur. This research is coming forth just by the volumes now, so that shouldn't be a problem.
And is your sense that... What is your sense will happen in the United States as a result of this research? Do you think we'll follow Sweden and just stop using amalgam?
It will take a while. Change never comes easy. But with more and more information, particularly coming to the public, they will force, I believe, the establishment to make the right changes. My particular role, I feel, is in teaching and making physicians aware of this problem, because most doctors, number one, do not know that mercury is in the filling. Susan, I didn't know that 5.5, 6 years ago. I didn't know I had it in my own teeth. Mm-hmm. It was a shock to me. And most physicians also do not know the various symptoms of mercury toxicity or how it can affect one person differently from another or how to even go about making the diagnosis. Diagnosing it is not easy either. And so my particular role, I feel, is in teaching my colleagues to become more aware of the problem and how to deal with it and how to handle it. And I've got my hands full with that one.
Mercury in your fillings.
Yes.
Love canal, leaching cancer-creating substances into the homes and bodies of the people who live there. I read recently that there is a mercury leaching into a playground in one of the communities on Alaska's coast. We drive through fumes.
Yes.
We have a far more stressful life than our happy ancestors who only carried clubs and hunted things and picked berries, right? I'm not exactly sure what the question is, except for we also notice that people don't move out en masse from Love Canal. They still live there. That we drive, whether we're in L.A. or Anchorage during an inversion or Fairbanks, through toxic conditions. We seem to be habituating ourselves to mercury by any other name, in our teeth or anywhere else. What do you expect humans should do, must do, to live in this world according to what you believe is a healthy way? We clearly have things all around us and
right.
inside us that are not healthy.
But there obviously is a difference between people, and some can come through it and survive it and even turn the tables around, whereas others just simply accept it or ignore it and they suffer the consequences. I think as a society we do need to become more educated, more aware of what we are being exposed to take our health, the responsibility for our health, into our own hands, and to start making changes, do what we can, make the changes that we can. And in doing that, we may be able to tolerate the things that are around us that we have no control over.
Is there a quick list of the most important things you think people should be paying attention to? Is diet number one?
Diet's number one. Stress management probably is number two, which diet would enter into part of that as well. Drinking pure water. Getting plenty of rest, not trying to burn the candle at both ends, or like the cartoon that says, "Doc, I didn't come to have you tell me I was burning the candle at both ends, but I came for more wax." I don't have more wax, so we have to do other things. Learning to get along with people better. I must say that the patients that come to me, many of them have come because they have begun reading. They are disappointed, I could use stronger words, but disappointed will have to do for now, in the care that they have had up till now. And so they've gone out to the library or the health food stores and they've gotten books and they started reading for themselves. And they seek out people that can help them. And they take an active part in their health. And they're the survivors. And they're coming through it. And they're turning the tables around and making change, not only making change in themselves, but the people that they work with and live with see the change, and they start asking questions, and it's a growing situation, which is wonderful.
Put it into your own hands.
That's right.
We've been talking today on Conversations to Dr. Sandra Denton, just to recap a bit. Two of her major interests are toxicology and the effects of poisons on people. She was for nearly 14 years an emergency physician, having taken her internship at St. Luke's Episcopal in Houston, Texas. She now works with Omni Medical Center in Anchorage, Alaska, and works in what we think of as alternative medicine. I'm Susan McInnes. This has been Conversations. We'll talk to you again.